Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck sticks, what the fucking ears, what the fucking Eastas? What's happening? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Thank you for listening. Welcome to the show. All of those of you who are insulated, perhaps working in the Arctic, welcome. Welcome those of you in labs. Welcome all people who repair shoes. Welcome. How are you? This is an interesting show today. Going to talk to Aziz Ansari. As you know, sometimes on this show, when fellow comedians have things to plug, and I have a relationship with that fellow comedian, and we want to talk about, you know, that project, have him on for a shorty. That's what we call him. Behind your back, we call him shorties. So this would be theoretically an Aziz shorty. But it's not, because Aziz and I got to talking about his new show, Master of None, and the nature of it, the reality of it. We sort of got into a nuts and bolts conversation, a little bit about, you know, making television. What sort of became a theme of our conversation is the idea that he is actually doing something that hasn't been done before, and in that the diversity of his show. There just became a conversation about the opportunities and the possibilities of working around the major networks to do things that haven't been done before. But Aziz and I have a nice chat. And then sort of an interesting thing happened. Robert Trujillo, the bass player of Metallica, is involved with a movie that I saw a screening of early on. This movie is about Jaco Pastorius. It's there's a big event for the premiere of the film. It's a concert and the film. That's going to be this Sunday, November 22nd at the Ace in Los Angeles. You can get tickets for that and get info on the screeners or pre-order the Blu-ray and DVD at Jaco, J-A-C-O, thefilm.com. Now, this is not any sort of paid plug. It's like, maybe I should talk about this before I bring them on. But this guy... You know, I'd always heard about Jaco Pastorius, and I'd always heard that he was this, you know, brilliant, genius, savant-like bass player that changed the entire game of bass playing. And, you know, he's on, you know, I think he played with, Weather Report and Joni Mitchell, did a couple solo records, but that's not necessarily my kind of music, right? Fusion, Joni Mitchell, not necessarily the first things I listened to or would necessarily even appreciate the bass so much, you know, in terms of focusing on it. And I'd always heard about him and the horrible, sad, sort of tragic end that he met. But it's just this tragic tale of a tortured genius, a pure artist, that I was asked to come see a rough cut of it. And I was thrilled about it and that it was happening. But these two guys are the best fucking rock bass players in the business. And they both came to talk about bass and talk about Jaco and to talk about the film a bit, because I think it's an important film. And, you know, I'm a music guy. So that's exciting. And that's going to happen. You're going to witness that. It's going to happen. It's going to happen right here on this show that you're listening to after Aziz Ansari. Yeah. So Aziz, me and Aziz, he's been on the show before, but like I said, we were going to just kind of talk about his new show. We ended up talking about a lot of things, and we ended up sort of coming around on some stuff, talking about, you know, the nature of television in a lot of ways, And it turned out to be a much more engaging conversation than even I expected, because I thought it was just going to be a little one, and it turned out to be kind of a medium-sized one. All right, so this is me and Aziz. As I said, the show is Master of None. It's streaming now on Netflix. Aziz, it's been a while since we were in here.
When was it? How long?
I don't fucking know. You don't know? Don't you keep track? You're a very meticulous guy. Aren't you on top of this stuff? Where's the... I thought you had some sort of large graph and table of your entire career that you just did like mathematics and everything was coming out fucking roses.
Is that some sort of strange Indian joke?
I hadn't thought about it, but you're doing great. I think the last time I saw you, we were in... It was coincidence. We were out of town. Why did we? What were we? How come we were at that hotel?
We were both in Boston.
That's right.
I can't remember why I was there. I think I was there for something for my book, and you were too. We were both doing something.
I was doing some weird conference thing.
We were both doing this weird thing in Boston,
and I was like, "Yo!" And then Paul Feig was there.
Yeah,
because he was shooting Ghostbusters.
Yeah, it was one of those things where you're by yourself in Boston.
Right.
It's like, comedians.
Yeah.
Somebody,
I know that
please,
guy.
Let's hang out in the lobby.
Let's eat dinner.
Yeah.
And then we talked for a while.
Yeah.
And he told me about the new show, and I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
And then.
But I enjoy talking to you.
What do you do? Do you have a place here now in LA?
I have a place here, yeah, that I got when I was doing Parks and Rec, but I mainly live in New York now.
So what do you do? You're just going to keep this place to hang out at?
Yeah, I still come back, and I don't know if we do a second season, if we'll end up writing in L.A., so you never really know.
Because the guys are here, some of them?
Alan lives here, who I created the show with, and the writers we worked with last time.
Oh, yeah, I thought I prepared. I did a little bit. Alan Yang.
Alan Yang.
Yeah, I got
Alan,
it.
You must be referring to Alan
Yang. Yes. But so when you guys created this, wasn't the late Harris Whittles involved as well?
He was. He was. He wrote with us until he passed, and he was, you know, when me and Alan weren't in the room, he was in charge of the writer's room, and he was a big part of it, and yeah, that was...
Devastating.
Awful experience.
And you guys had known each other for a while? Harris and Alan, right? Are y'all from Parks and Rec? Is that where...
Yeah, I'd known Harris from stand-up before he wrote on Parks and Rec, and he opened up for me on the road a few times. He
did
open up for me when I did a show in Houston, and I met some of his family years ago, and so whenever I went back to Houston, I would see some of his friends and stuff, so I had a little connection to him from Houston as well, and I worked with him on a couple of scripts, and movie scripts, and then when Alan and I decided to do this show, he was the first person we wanted to get to write with us.
And that's how it started, and then how many was he involved with in terms of actually writing? The first few, or how did you? It's hard.
It's crazy because I remember exactly the moment of getting that phone call and everything.
Horrible.
And so I know exactly how long it was and everything. He was there up until about like episode 8 or something.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
So most of them.
For most of them. I remember me and Alan were trying to figure out this one episode. And we were walking by ourselves, like we stepped away from the writer's room, and we were kind of walking by ourselves, and we were trying to figure out this episode, and I got that call, and it was insane, and we couldn't even process it, and we just walked around for a while, and
in light of that horrible thing, and just the legacy of working with him, I don't know that a lot of people know how a writing room works or how that creative process in television works, because I'm in the middle of it now, and when you were creating Master of None, how many people? Like, who were the writers? Because, like, you know a lot of the same guys I do, and a lot of people who listen to the show know it. Because I know, I don't know Alan Yang, but I knew Harris.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Wareheim, Eric Wareheim's involved, right?
Yeah, he acted in the show, and he directed 4 episodes.
No writing?
He didn't write on the show, no.
So who was in the room? Like, how many people?
Myself,
yeah.
Alan, my brother, Anis.
Is he in show business? He is now.
It's interesting. He'd done kind of other jobs in
older, younger.
World. He's younger brother. He's 25, and I was trying to think of people to hire. I wanted to get someone a little bit younger, and I just thought he would be great because I just know how funny he is in real life, and just It's interesting. I remember reading this thing with Greg Daniels once.
Who created The Office.
The Office in the U.S. Parks, and he would use writing samples that were non-traditional. It wasn't always just like a spec script. It could just be an article someone wrote that was funny, or just different kinds of things that just showed that someone had an interesting sense of humor.
Right, because in the room, that's sort of all that counts. I mean, ultimately, whoever's going to write the script is going to write the script.
Yeah, the other stuff, the nuts and bolts stuff, can easily be taught. What can't be taught is like having that unique comedic perspective.
Sure.
And he was always so funny. Like, he would be on email chains with me and, like, other comedy guys. Like, I have this long, like, bit email chain with him, my brother, and the Lonely Island guys. And he would just write these emails that made us laugh so hard. And I was like, Anis is really funny. He's a really good writer. And Alan knows him personally, too. And it was a no-brainer. So we were like, let's get Anis. That'll be a great idea to have, like, a young writer like him on board.
And what's your dynamic with him, though? Was there brotherly shit going on?
No, I think he was very excited to be here and was a little bit shy at first, but he grew as a writer in the room, and he got a lot of stuff on, a lot of great jokes in the show that people quote are lines that he pitched. So there was him, this writing duo, these women, Sarah Peters and Zoe Jarman, Joe Mandy, who wrote on Parks.
I just saw him. I love Joe. Yeah, I did stand up with him the other night. Yeah. Very funny.
Yeah, he came on as soon as Parks was done. He came on board and helped us out, and Harris was writing with us, and who else? A couple of people popped in when they could. Andrew Weinberg, he wrote with us a little bit. Jason Wollner wrote a little bit, and Andy Blitz. If I left anyone out, please know in my heart, I really appreciated the work you did on the show, and it was a mistake, because I'm very nervous talking to Mark.
No, you're not.
I'm not. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, so the hardest part about doing this stuff is, for me, and maybe for you, is breaking stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's tedious, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of tough to, if you have an idea. For example, like one of the episodes that was really hard was this episode called Indians on TV that we wrote. And we had this idea. We had so many ideas, and the script went through so many drafts, and it took a while to land on the story that we did and the plot mechanics that we landed on. And it just takes a while. And a lot of writing on that show was just us just discussing things in the room. And a lot of times we would be arguing about something, and then Alan and I would be like, this is good. We should just put this argument in the episode. This is very real and interesting.
Well, that episode in particular is sort of provocative to me, because I think a lot of people who watch this, but not necessarily myself, I mean, that story that I've heard from a black perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on some level, that story of like, you know, why do we have to play slaves? Why do we always got to play criminals? Why do we always get like, but that there's been some progress along those lines in racial casting, but still not a lot. But then to hear from an Indian perspective, like, because I've heard like Maz Jobrani do bits about it, and maybe I don't know if you do actual comedy bits about it, but that story was really interesting to me, because you would never see someone do blackface.
Yeah.
To do a black part, you know, certainly not in the modern world, if ever, but that actually happens. That you were actually to find one real source. Was that a real, that was a real thing, right?
The Fisher Stevens thing. Well, what was interesting is after we did that episode, I talked to more and more people about this, and everyone has their version of it to an extent. We did an episode called Old People, and this actress, Lynn Cohen, played my girlfriend's grandma.
Yeah.
And she talked to me, and she was, and after she read the script, and she was like, this is great. I never get anything like this where it's a fully rounded character. I usually get these old people roles where I'm like getting hurt and hurting my hip, or I'm a rapping granny. And I was like, oh, like that's her version of, you know, convenience store guy or whatever, or taxi cab driver. Like I think part of it is all the people that do this stuff are younger people, so they don't have those stories in their head necessarily to tell. And when they think of old people, they just think of them as props for whatever goofy gag or whatever, and they don't always consider their lives as having some sort of compelling story they need to
Full
put into
life.
Their things.
Yeah. Right, but you did that too also with, I think that another thing that most of like my generation has gotten away from, and my generation not being that much older than you, but like our grandparents or maybe great-grandparents, you know, especially if you're like a Jew like myself, that was the first generation immigrant story, was the, you know, the Ellis Island, you know, it was all European, most of it, you know, that first generation in the 1900s. But that's sort of like our connection to that experience. And yours is like your parents.
Yeah.
And the story of a first generation immigrant who's not European, and it's within the last 30 years, is you don't see a lot of that. And it was interesting to me in watching that episode about you and what's the other actor's name, the Asian kid?
Calvin Yu.
Calvin Yu. That you know, it was just it's a very specific story that you may see in some independent films about that specifically, but you know, not in a mainstream comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But it also seems that the two of you, whether how true it is to the characters or not, are insanely detached from the first generation immigrant story of the people that you grew up with.
Yeah, I think part of it is the kids just not thinking about it, and I think another
taking
part
it for granted.
Taking it for granted and just be like, yeah, I guess it was hard. And then also I think a big part of it is the parents are very closed off emotionally and don't share those kind of stories with the kids. I really learned a lot about those stories because I did that episode and asked my parents so many questions. Same with Alan. I think Alan knew a little bit about his dad's story. The story of the Brian character's dad in the show is pretty close to what happened to Alan's father, the story about the chicken and all those things. And with my dad, the stuff is pretty close to what happened to him as well.
Your Indian heritage, is it important to you?
I think it's obviously something that defines who you are, where you're from, and
but I mean, do you think about it?
I think you can't help but have it be a part of who you are and your life and how you interact with people. I don't think it's like every single moment I'm like, I'm Indian. It's not that kind of thing, but I don't think anyone has that.
Well, I don't know. I just read Ta-Nehisi Coates' book about the black experience, and it seems to be pretty, you know.
That's a crazy book, right?
But it, clearly half of it, most of it is about that consciousness that is unavoidable, that, you know, at all times, in all situations.
No, that's true.
And there's a self-consciousness and censorship that goes around with that.
But it's almost like, you know, when he tells that story of being in the movie theater with his kid and that woman kind of pushes his kid, I feel like he kind of forgot for a second, and then that happens and he's like, oh shit,
I could get in real trouble just because.
And it's that story is an insane story.
It's
and
a great
I
book.
Think it and I think it's like that for me. It's like, oh, it will be out of my head, and then I'll get some script where it's like, oh, do an accent. It's like, oh, I forgot. Like, that's what people think of Indian people and Indian actors.
It was interesting to me in seeing the character, which I imagine is pretty close to you, have a certain amount of surprise and distance from your own sort of heritage, because you were so identified in the show as well with the generational problems of where you're at just as a guy. It all seems pretty well integrated that that most of the show, you cover the bases around you know what people's assumptions are you ethnically, and then the thing about with your parents, but a lot of it is really just navigating culture as, you know, a dude who's in his 30s trying to date and trying to
exactly just being a dude. But I think by virtue of just being an Indian guy and that being my life, these things do come up organically for me and for the character. And I think that's why it works in the show.
Well, how did you figure out, like, I want to know what the meeting was where you're sitting in the writer's room, because, like, the sort of recurring crew, you know, the friends coffee shop idea of who you're hanging out with, you know, you got the Asian friend, and then you've got an African-American lesbian friend, and then you've got, you know, a big white doofus.
The token white friend.
But so classically, like, kind of like, you know?
Well, there was no discussion of, oh, let's, it's interesting seeing this big reaction to the diversity in the show, because it wasn't, I didn't expect it to be such a thing, but I think what happened was this.
What is the reaction? I'm not checking every day.
Well, I check everything, Googling all the time. The reaction is, wow, I've never seen, a show where an Indian guy's having sex with someone. I haven't seen an Asian guy who's not like this super nerd. Like, you know, there's articles about Kelvin being like this heartthrob in the show, and you never see that. There's no Asian heartthrobs. There's no Asian men are desexualized,
right?
And then they're like, oh, and then the other friend is an African American lesbian, and this is a good representation of that character. And then there's one white guy, and it's usually the reverse. It's usually three white people and one minority or you know, someone different. But the way it happened on the show was, so the Kelvin's character is based on Alan. So that's that. So we were always going to have an Asian guy.
Yeah.
And it was going to be a you know, proxy for Alan.
Right.
And then we wanted a female friend, and we worked with Allison Jones, who's, you know, casting.
Yeah, she's great.
Legend, just incredible. Yeah. And she just started introducing us to all these people. And I did chemistry reads with everyone that wanted to read for this part.
Chemistry read mean just how
it's like an audition
vibe,
where I'm right. I'm there and connected. We're really improvising a lot and, mm-hmm. and just kind of really trying to see if there's a chemistry there.
Mm-hmm.
And our favorite was Lena, Lena Waithe, who plays Denise. And we were like, this person's incredible. Never seen this person on TV. This kind of energy and who she is. And we just changed the whole character to be her. And so that's how that character came about. It wasn't like Alan and I sat down like, what if we got an African-American lesbian woman to mm-hmm. be my friend? Like, there was never that conversation. And then Eric is a friend of mine in real life. So, and all these characters, and then Noelle was, who's my girlfriend's show, was another person. We auditioned so many women. I did so many auditions with people and improvised with all these women. And she was a person I had the best chemistry with and seemed like the funniest and most natural performer. And so we cast them all based on their talent. Mm-hmm. And I think it reflects Alan and I's reality. When we hang out, I mean, there is an Indian guy and an Asian guy there, you know? And we do have black friends. And Eric is a friend. So all these characters are kind of based on the performers. And I think the reason it feels different is because it's authentic to me and my...
right.
In my social circles.
Right.
It's not like, you know, if they made Seinfeld now, I don't think they should cast Seinfeld any different than they did. Like, that reflects a reality that's there, right?
Sure.
And I don't think it's about, oh, we'll make one of Jerry's friends Asian now or something. Like, no, I don't think that's the answer.
Right.
I think what we did works because it's very authentic. I think the answer would be, if you're doing a show like Seinfeld now, if you do cast an Asian guy, maybe don't cast him only when you need a guy that's like... Yeah. Working, you know, the long
right.
Yeah,
you don't want to do quota casting.
Yeah, I think that feels fake and
phony. I guess some people
we've all seen those shows where you're like, I don't think that black guy would hang out with these people.
Yeah.
I really think he's being forced into this friend group. In real life, this guy would not hang out with these three other people. But and those shows are on.
Sure.
You know the shows.
Sure.
So it's kind of tough to find that middle ground where it feels authentic and doesn't feel like quota casting. And for us, it was very authentic because me and Alan are friends, and those are those two guys. And then Lena was just our favorite person that auditioned, and we made that character her. And
Eric
I really
Eric.
Am friends with yeah. her now, and it all feels real, and Eric is Eric. Yeah.
Well, I guess a lot of people are going to sort of project whatever they think is like, well, this is intentional. It's trying, yeah.
I really didn't expect it to be this thing, but it's cool. And I'm glad that people are seeing it and being like, wow, this is a cool depiction of Asian Americans. Because, you know, we were aware of the Asian American stuff a little bit. Like Alan had asked me when we were shooting, he said something to me once. He was like, how many times have you seen an Asian guy kiss someone? And I was like, well, I mean, not in real life. He meant like on TV and film.
Because in real life, you see it all the time.
In real life, you can't avoid it.
Yeah,
and I was like, wow, you really don't see it. There really is this whole thing of desexualizing Asian men and Indian men on television and film. And so to see them portrayed the way Kelvin portrays a character of Brian, where he's sexually capable, confident, good-looking guy, it is sadly an anomaly.
And also, like, it's... There's an element to it that it is a uniquely American experience
mm-hmm.
that you're sort of capturing. And I think that, you know, some people keep, you know, they'd rather generalize that ethnically than just see everybody as like, well, they're just, you know, people, American people who are living their lives.
I someone wrote me on Twitter. They were like, it's cool to see a group of friends on TV that look like my group of friends.
Right.
And I do think you see sometimes on like network shows, you see these four people, you're like, all right, I mean, these are really attractive white people that are hanging out together. I guess
right.
that's a thing.
It's homogenized.
And I think what's strange is, I think so much of TV and film is the kind of proxy for the everyman is a super good-looking white guy. And the truth is, not many people relate to that guy.
Right.
You
not
know,
anymore.
He's not everybody.
Yeah, I guess probably ever. I mean, it was always a fantasy in the first place. You know, the whole idea of movies and movie stars. And
yeah, I guess it kind of started out with this thing of, oh, like, let's live vicariously through...
Right. The myth.
This whoever this guy
right.
is.
Yeah.
And then now it's kind of like people are like, all right. What's interesting to me, what I've learned doing from the show is there's so many stories to tell that we haven't told at all.
Ever.
They're just amazing stories about people that have just been so, just never been in the forefront of the stories we tell. And we're just slowly scratching the surface as more and more creators are coming from different backgrounds and ethnicities.
Right.
And to me, that's very exciting. Just the idea of just like more interesting stories out in the world.
Because the cultural landscape is dramatically changing. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, to even get a sense of what, you know, the population looks like becomes tricky in terms of like what, you know, how many people really relate to this. But the weird thing is that there's no denying that it's changing and it's more inclusive and it's for the better. But still, it seems that some mediums are just slow to get to it.
Yeah.
And you seem to be sort of on the forefront of some of that.
It takes time to be able to do this stuff well, too. I think Alan and I, you know, we had a lot of experience through Parks and Rec and other things we've done, so we were able to do this in a good way and make it feel right. And I think if we'd done this show when we were younger, it wouldn't have been any good. I think it would have probably been a fine show, but it wouldn't have been what it is now. And I think over time, as more and more people like me and Alan go through our careers and gain experience to make shows like Master of None or whatever, hopefully we'll get more and more of these kind of shows and stories and films and whatever.
I just think it's impressive that you have friends. You know, like I'm not a guy, like, I have friends, but I don't spend time with a lot of people. So, like, somehow or another, I guess there are some people that, you know, go out in the world and they hang out with friends. I guess I never really led a normal life like that because I was a comic and I spent most of my life in fucking comedy clubs. And I didn't, you know, I was not, you know, working with other people or writing with other people. Mm-hmm. I had, a few guys that I'd see and be like, hey, you know, we're friends because we're comics. But I don't generally spend time with a lot of people. So maybe that's my, that's why I feel excluded from everything. Like, when I'm watching anything and I'm like, people don't hang out and talk. What the fuck? But that's my own problem.
But that was a thing in the show where we made it so every episode it's not the same four people show up all the time. We made it so, oh, whatever the story is, whatever that episode's about, let's bring in the other people as we need them.
Yeah.
Because we were writing, we're like, that character wouldn't be here right now.
But like, also it seems like, you know, you as a person, like, you know, in terms of being able to do the show and having the experience that, you know, you seem to be consciously and with effort evolving as a human being around women, around, you know, relationships, or like you're sort of aware. Like my girlfriend was very happy about the episode that dealt with women's safety and that self-awareness of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, even those stories aren't really told comedically that often.
It's hard to do. It's hard to do it and not come off preachy and to make it feel real. And you don't want it to seem like you're trying to, like, pat yourself on the back or anything like that. But as far as, like, evolving as a performer, the analogy I always used is I've always liked bands that put out albums that show a growth and
right.
change, but kind of maintain an essence, be it something like the Beastie Boys or Radiohead or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that's the goal is to keep evolving as an artist and getting better and doing different things.
But it's
and
interesting.
Pushing yourself.
It seems to me like, I don't know how aware of it you are or what your consciousness is around it, but like, I think early on in your career, you're a sort of observational comedian, mm-hmm. you know, who did, you know, sort of skewed stuff with a certain rhythm. And, you know, a lot of it was focused on, you know, having a kind of point of view around reality that was new. And then, like, as you became more a person with success and I guess some money and some, you know, awareness of yourself out in the world and with women and stuff, that you really started to sort of delve into, you know, relationship material, which is hard to do in a new way.
Yeah, I think an advantage I had was I'm younger than people realize sometimes, I think. And so,
how old are you?
I'm 32 now. But when I was doing that stuff, I was, you know, in my late 20s, and there were things that people weren't talking about because a lot of the comedians that were at the level I was doing theaters and things like that were older, so they were either married or divorced or whatever.
Yeah. Already
they're already past that stage where they were young and kind of out and
no hope.
Of dealing with that stuff. So it gave me an interesting opportunity to kind of talk about this stuff in a new way as a comedian that was
living
at that
it.
Level.
And but you didn't, there was never a point in time where, like, you know, you were talking about your own experience through jokes about relationships where you were sort of like, you know, I wonder if this has been covered before.
Well, I think with anything, it's really about your take on it, and
sure,
whatever you're talking about.
No,
and you can kind of tell if you can kind of go out to the clubs and hear what people are doing and hear kind of the common
takes. Yeah, yeah.
And you know if yours is different enough to where it's worth doing. I think so.
And
I
also,
mean, that's how I felt. With all the stuff I did, I felt like I did it in a way where it differentiated itself from the more obvious.
Right, because generationally, you know, primarily because of technology and a strange lack of, you know, real engagement with people, that the obstacles are different. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't, you know, there was no texting when I was, you know, I mean, I've dealt with that in my adult life, but I'm still an old man, like, going like, this is exciting. You just... but for your generation, which is, you know, you're 20 years younger than me, you know, it's just normal. It's how you engage. You almost hardly, like, there's a chance that you will never have seen or even talked to the person before in real life, before you meet them.
It's crazy how these very once universal human experiences kind of die away. For example, just the idea of a guy nervously calling a woman on the phone.
Right.
That's gone. I mean, there's a certain generation that has no idea.
Or their leaving a message even.
Yeah, now the version is like, what do I send in this first text? It's like, that's not that scary. That's much less scary than like hearing that ring and hearing someone go hello. And
yeah,
then
you missed out.
I mean, that's a crazy moment. I mean, I had the tail end of that.
Yeah. you missed out on the nervous first call. Hey,
yeah, but that used to be, that's something that everyone could relate to it to a certain age, and now it's gone.
Yeah, I don't know where all the time goes, you know, like, because you never feel like you have time, and all this stuff was supposed to make life more convenient for us, but it actually makes it more insane.
Well, there's a good and a bad, you know.
Sure.
For you know, I think there's some people that are like, oh, I can text and now I don't have to be as nervous, and I can, it doesn't feel as forward, and now we kind of build a rapport on text and things are better for me in that way.
Is that thing in that one episode where, you know, the woman just goes on dates to get free food, is that a real thing?
That's a real thing. Someone told us, one of the writers mentioned that there was some girl that worked in their office that would just go on OkCupid dates.
To have good food?
Just use the guys for free food. Yeah, I think that's a thing some people do in cities like New York. They'll just go on these OkCupid dates and just use people for food.
And so what happens now? You got the book out and this is, you know, the show's going. Do you know if you're going to do more? Are you going to do more?
They haven't officially said, but I
why not, right?
I think they'd probably want to do more. If we did a season two, I would just want to take some time to have some stuff happen to me and make sure that what we did was as good as what we
did. Is there anything I can do to help? You want me to lock you in the garage for 2 days?
Hey, that'd be an episode. That'd be a strange one, but sure.
and what about stand-up? Are you in it? Are you taking a break? Are you writing new shit? What are you doing?
Stand-up, I wrote about, I had like about 40 minutes that I did for the Oddball tour over the summer.
Right, right.
And I might go back into the clubs and try to just finish an hour and do a tour, but I kind of want to write some more scripts and stuff before I do a tour, because sometimes I feel like I just go to stand-up and I let...
It's easy, it's what we do.
Writing go down. And
like write
like
what,
script writing.
Like a movie?
Like a movie or more episodes of the show or whatever, I don't
but
know.
But is that sort of where the momentum in your mind, is that sort of the next plateau, is to sort of follow the you know, to break the mold of sort of what you talked about in that episode and actually have a nice big movie that stars Indian leading men and you know.
Well, I think I did that with Master of None, even though it's not a movie. I was thinking about that, whether I'd want to do a movie, and I realized, well, Master of None, I get to do whatever I want.
They're, yeah, I get that.
Very
sure.
Open to every ideas we want to do. Me and Alan have so much control on the show.
Creative freedom.
And I don't know what I would get out of doing a movie. And so many people watch the show. I mean, so many people got to see the show.
No, I know. Movies are a chore, man.
Movies are tough. You got to get out there, and then you see the weekend box office numbers. It's a different
just to
thing.
Get it made. It's like, you know, you think like, oh, well, anyone can make one. We got the technology, but it's not easy, man.
It seems like a struggle, and I feel like I have such a great situation with Netflix and the show. Obviously, there's part of me that wants to do that, and there are limited. I can't tell every story I want to tell through the show. Like, if I wanted to do something where I played a totally different character, that might be weird to do in the show. I mean, granted, we play around with a lot of stuff, but I think it might be hard.
You
to
You could
do
like
things.
If you wanted to, though, if you really wanted to play with length and stretching out a narrative. You know, in the next season, you could do an hour first episode. Like, you
sure,
could,
yeah. I mean, I think Netflix is very creatively supportive of anything we want to do, but. Yeah, there is something cool about movies.
Yeah,
and just doing a cool movie and making. If I made like one really good movie, I'd be so thrilled. If I had like one really good one that I directed and wrote and acted in, I'd be thrilled. That would be awesome.
How many did you direct, The Masters and None?
Master and None, I did two of them. I did the parents episode and the Nashville episode.
No, and those were your real parents?
Those are my real parents, yeah. Yes.
So you had your brother and your parents.
Very crazy, you know, to have.
Is that
such
your only brother?
As my little only sibling, my little brother. Yeah, it's very, very surreal. I was thinking about it when we went to we had a premiere for the show in New York, and my whole family was there. I was like, wow, this is like probably the biggest thing I've done in my career, probably the most well received thing I've done in my career. And my parents are in it, and my brother helped me write it. Pretty cool to have my whole immediate family be such a big part of it. Not even a little part, a big part. It wasn't like my parents did like a little cameo.
Yeah.
They're in a few episodes. My brother helped write on every episode. You know, even though all the episodes, most of them say written by Aziz and Alan, you know, they were written in a room and everyone pitched ideas and jokes
that's
that
the way
made
it
in the episode. And that's how those writer's rooms work.
Yeah.
And to have my whole family be a part of something that ended up being such a big thing in my career is really special.
Are they excited?
Yeah, I think they're thrilled, you know. I think, you know, my dad's getting all these emails from people that have seen the show, like distant relatives, random Indian people that just live in North Carolina.
they got new friends now. You're close by. Where do you guys go to eat? Well, thanks, Aziz. I think, where are you headed now?
I don't know. I think, I'm just running around. I might have a little bit of a breather. I might just go home for a little bit.
All right, buddy. Good talking to you.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Aziz. It is a good show. Some good shit in it. It is kind of, it's sort of interesting. The idea of, you know, what makes somebody an artist? You know, what makes somebody, it's like, I was talking before and even talking to Aziz, it's like the work that goes in, that once you sort of refine what you are and what you do and the craft of what you do, then, you know, the job and the work of bringing that to whatever you're going to bring that to is really the fucking, that's where, you know, the, what is it? The tire meets the pavement, the wood meets the saw, the fist meets the face. What is it? That's where it happens, man. And, you know, it's very hard, you know, being a self-employed person to know when you're not, when does work stop? It never stops. It's fucking 9 at night and I'm recording this right now and I wrote all day and this morning I did an interview. It's crazy. And the only thing that's making me sane is I learned how to make this bread that I've always been curious about. that's how I take a break. I'm going to engage in the artistry of baking. It's not even a real bread. It's more of this dense brick. It's there's a place in New York called Angelica. It's a vegan place, but they make this sort of brick-like rice bread that I always thought was some sort of mystery. But it's weird with food. You just go online and you look up something, and it's like, I wonder if I can make that. And you're like, holy shit, I can make this. So now I have an entire brick of this rice bread. It's literally a dense brick-like substance. And I have no family. I have no people. You know, Sarah, I give Sarah half of it, but I'm still left with half a massive brick of rice bread. And you know what I do with that? Shove it in my face. So whatever health elements might have been at the core of it, the idea of it, are lost because I've just consumed the equivalent of 90 bowls of rice and 5 bowls of oatmeal. Sounds good. A lot of carbs. I'm about to fall asleep. All right, now, I know a lot of you are going to be like, are you going to have Robert and Flea back separately to not just, you know, to talk separately? But I think you'll be surprised at how much we were able to cover and also the interaction between these two guys who, you know, have been around L.A. for a long time, talking about bass, talking about bands. It was a real fucking thrill to have Flea in here and to have Robert Trujillo in here and also to be part of people seeing this movie, Jaco. The film is pretty amazing, and it's a documentary of a real American genius. And as I said before, there's a premiere and a concert this Sunday, November 22nd at the Ace in Los Angeles, and you can get tickets for that and info on screenings. You can pre-order the Blu-ray and DVD at JacoTheFilm.com. So now let's talk to Robert Trujillo and Flea.
Sonny had a Harry Potter party, and we I dressed up like Dumbledore.
Oh, yeah.
And my friend in my guest house dressed up like Voldemort, and we had owls, all this stuff.
What?
We had a bottle with the wands. I was up all night.
Who's that, your kid?
Yeah, I had seven little girls sleep over my house last night.
Oh, my God.
It was mayhem, pandemonium.
No sleep?
Fucking insanity.
No sleepy sleeps. But it must have been probably more fun than a night of blow.
Anything's more fun than a night of blow.
Well, look, I wanted to talk to both of you guys because did you guys know each other when you were kids?
We were young adults.
Young adults.
When did you meet? Because you both grew up in the area, right?
It's hard to remember because it was a while ago. But I remember you in this very colorful Mercedes Benz with multicolored.
Yeah.
It looked like a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
And I just got off tour with Suicidal Tendencies, and I'm driving from the airport with whoever I was with. And I look to my right, and I see Flea. And he was with some Rasta guy, some dude with dreadlocks, and he's no shirt.
Yeah.
He's picking his nose, like picking a winner. And that was a classic moment. I didn't even want to say hi.
We met before that, though.
No, we met before. We met at the Roxy.
And over to Stephen Perkins.
Yeah, with Stephen. Actually, Infectious Grooves had played a show at the Palace in Hollywood.
Yeah, I remember that.
And you were there.
Yep.
And that was when I first started jamming with Stephen. And I mean, everybody was there. It was kind of a crazy scene.
Who was the Rasta guy? Was it Clinton? Was it George
who
Clinton?
Was that Rasta guy back in the day?
It might have been D.H. Peligro.
Yeah.
Oh, D.H. Yeah. I know D.H.
Yeah, it might have been Dirty D.
Yeah, I see him around.
Yeah.
The things.
Me too.
So, you guys didn't ever play on the same bill when you were kids, because you were both like kicking around. When did you start playing bass?
I knew about Robert.
From Suicidal Tendencies.
From Suicidal, and before that I just knew Robert was a bass player around.
To be reckoned with?
Just a dude that played bass that could rock, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You lived in Venice, right?
Right.
In
Venice. They used to call me the Mexi Casualty.
Why?
They'd say, Mexi Casualty! I don't know. It was just... And then Zach Wilde used to call me the Whiskey Warlord because of this phase I went through with Crown and Ginger.
Oh, yeah?
And Crown Royal, yeah. I don't know. You get these nicknames.
Sure, man.
Yeah.
So who were the bands you guys, when you were coming up, early on, when you were living in Venice, and where were you living? Up here?
Yeah, well, I was born in Australia. I left Australia when I was four. I moved to New York. I left New York when I was 11 in 1972 and moved to Hollywood, 72.
So that's when the Hollywood started.
Yeah.
Yeah, and your dad was a musician?
My stepdad was a jazz musician, so I was brought up around jazz. And
that was the first thing that you sort of gravitated towards?
Yeah, I wanted to be a jazz trumpet player when I was a kid. That was my first thing. And then in high school, the bass just came up in rock bands, and I stood a much better chance of getting laid.
Oh, yeah? So it was about pussy?
It was all about pussy.
For you too?
For me, pussy?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess at a certain point it was. You know, I think
I talked to a lot of performers where it's like, that was it.
Well,
how are you going to do it?
You know, you think about it, you think about back in the day, and it's all about all of that. I mean, my fondest memories playing music, even up to today, were playing backyard parties in Venice, you know?
Yeah.
And we played everything from Van Halen to Jimi Hendrix to Ozzy, who I eventually started to work with over the years, which was kind of surreal. But we even played La Via Strangiato by Rush. And exactly. Yeah, you know, we were always trying to go for the challenge.
And did you rock La Via Strangiato?
Yeah, we did in YYZ. I don't know how good we played it, but we tried. But before that, growing up, I actually, my parents were into a lot of different styles of music, so I had a lot of Motown and James Brown in my life, and as well as my, sabicas, because my dad was a flamenco guitar player.
He was?
So that's how, by hobby, but that's why I remember seeing that fingering style, and that's kind of how I started playing. I didn't play with a pick initially, it was all sort of finger.
Is that where you got that chord thing going?
Probably, you know, when you're young, you know, super young, I was a baby, and that's the first instrument I saw being played was a nylon
flamenco guitar.
Flamenco, yeah. And then over the years I started to discover other styles of music, but funk, like funk music, the Ohio Players, the first concert I ever went to was the Isley Brothers in like 1975 or something.
Oh, really?
76.
Oh, Highway Players, that was fire.
Right.
And Roller Coaster.
Yeah, Roller Coaster. But the Isley Brothers were like bringing riffs. You know? They were bringing like the metal to the funk. So, you know, that's when I discovered bass and... Here I am.
Patti Smith told me that she was at her high school prom in Chicago. Two bands were playing at a high school prom, like one in a real popular room, and she went in there and all the kids were in there.
Yeah.
And it was, I don't know, some lame top 40 band. And she went to the other room and no one was in there. And the Isley Brothers were in there playing with Hendrix on guitar.
What? Yeah, what?
Fucking Jimi Hendrix on guitar at her high school prom with the Isley Brothers.
That's right. He was with him for like a couple of years, right?
Yeah, you know, a little phase before he met, what's his name from the Animals, Eric Burdon.
So like when you were starting out, just you were playing jazz when you were a kid?
I was like getting ready to play jazz. I was playing trumpet and I was very... into it and romancing it and just into
bebop, the whole
Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie. I met Dizzy Gillespie when I was a kid. I was around jazz all the time.
Art Pepper. Was he around? Did your dad know those guys?
No, but he knew. He played with Dizzy a little bit. He played with Philly Joe Jones. He played with some guys, but he never really made it happen. His people skills weren't so good. Yeah. You know, and heroin is never good for stuff. Oh, you know?
So he was one of those guys that got the heroin, but not so much.
No, he's a great player. Yeah. I don't mean to demarginalize.
Is he still around?
No, unfortunately, he died a few years ago.
But he got strung out?
Yeah, he got real strung out. And he got straight. You know, he got on a program and got straight and stuff. But I grew up loving jazz. But just talking about like Robert and I coming up as bass players in L.A., I was thinking when I was driving up here, I was thinking like one of the great feel good stories in the history of rock is when Robert Trujillo joins Metallica.
Yeah.
Like we all saw the movie and we saw that moment. And I remember seeing that and it was like so heartwarming and beautiful, you know, and you join Metallica and it's like so great.
Yeah.
But for me and for other people that I know who like came up in the club scene in LA playing, it was like a victory for all of us. It was like, you know, for all the LA homies, it was like Robert Trujillo is in fucking Metallica. And this is cool. Like it was just like not only was it a match made in heaven, but it was just awesome.
Yeah.
Like
yeah,
it was just such a great, beautiful thing. So anyways,
was that a big day for you?
It was a very surreal day for me.
Yeah.
And it was but when you get a gig like that, you know, it's so strange, really strange is the word, because I remember going up there. I was late. I was always late back then.
For the audition?
This would have been in 2003. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a quick story about the audition.
Right.
Let's go to the audition. Okay. Basically, it was a 2-day audition. The first day of the audition, I was kind of just there to be a fly on the wall.
Right.
Bob Rock's there. The bass had already been recorded. Bob Rock recorded the bass. So I'm just hanging around. And Lars and James and Kirk kind of live in this bubble.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and, you know, they were just like, you know, make yourself at home. You know, just hang out. And I'm just kind of hanging out in this big complex.
Is up in the Bay Area?
Up, you know, up north. And I'm kind of lost because no one's really completely communicating with me and I'm just there.
Yeah.
And okay, so I'm in, you know, come on in the control room and I'm just there. They're cutting tracks and that's it, hanging around. 11 o'clock rolls around at night and Lars, we're in the parking lot, we're the last ones leaving, and Lars says, hey man, let's go get a drink. Let's go get a nightcap.
Yeah.
So I'm like, all right. And we go to the first bar, have a couple cocktails. We go to the second bar, have a few more. Go to the third bar. Then we end up at his house for more cocktails. By this time, it's 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, I can't even drive to wherever I'm staying. And it's just, it's impossible. And he even says, here, crash out in my guest room.
Right.
So at 9 in the morning, 4 hours later, he's on the treadmill, this guy. And it's like he doesn't know me anymore. You know, he's already sobered up and he's on a treadmill.
Right, yeah.
And I've got this crazy headache.
Yeah.
And then he's like, all right, let's go to the studio. And I'm driving behind him, you know, couldn't even keep my eyes open.
Yeah.
I get to the studio and this is when they were going through this sort of therapy thing.
Yeah.
This guy called Phil Toll.
Right.
Who was a...
that's in the movie.
Yeah. What do they call it? Like kind of a life coach, kind of a motivator, which was at the time, I guess, good for the band. But I wasn't used to that. I was just, and here I am with a pounding headache. James has just gone through this whole thing where, of course, he's sober. And
right.
The last person he wants to see anywhere near his band is a drunk Mexican, you know? And so what me, that would be me.
Ex-casualty.
Ex-casualty was in full effect. Yeah. So I'm sitting at the table and I'm like, got the worst headache, completely hungover. And I'm thinking Lars did this to me because he was, you know, checking me out to see if I could hang
the
with
test.
Him. It was the test. It had to have been.
Yeah.
He's a Viking, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I came up with the idea, because I go into the bathroom, I was throwing water on my face, slapping it, going, oh, man, you got to hang in there, hang in there. Because I really wanted to say, I can't do this right now, guys. Sure, yeah. I don't feel good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I really can't do this. I stuck it out. I knew the tech, the bass tech from back when Suicidal Tendencies was touring with Metallica, which would have been in 1993 on the Black Album.
So he knew, those guys knew you.
They knew me from back then.
Right.
Yeah. And here we are 10 years later. And so Zach Harmon, who is now still my bass tech, I didn't have a bass. So, mm-hmm. Oh, well, let's go grab a bass. Let's choose the amp setup. So I kind of used that as my way to get out of this hangover situation. And when I watch Some Kind of Monster, I see myself wearing this brown Armani t-shirt, which I would never own in my life.
Right.
You know why? Because it's not mine. It's Lars's.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
His wife at the time, Skylar, gave me that shirt because the one I'd been wearing, which was probably pretty funky, was not happening. So anyway, that's I'm sure he was sizing me up. And
How'd you perform?
We played Battery, and I think it helped me not be nervous.
Yeah.
And that's what you see in the film, and everybody seems to think it was pretty slamming.
Yeah.
But other than that, I was brain dead. I couldn't, if I could play, I was fine. But in communicating with Hetfield, because he would come over to me and ask me questions, and I would come up with really stupid answers because literally I was not all there.
Yeah, you're fucked up.
I was, man.
So, Flea, like, what, in a relative way, you know, when you were pretty young when you met Anthony, right?
Yeah, we were 15.
So where was the moment where you knew you had a fucking band?
Well, we were inseparable from when we were 15.
Yeah.
Literally,
yeah.
I mean, we did everything together. Bad stuff. We were bad kids.
Yeah, yeah.
We were robbing houses.
Oh, yeah?
Hustling drugs and stealing and just bad.
Playing music?
I was playing music. He had no interest in playing music.
Right.
Yeah, I was playing in bands and, you know, I started playing in a rock. I was getting ready. I know I was a couple of years away from playing in a rock band, but I was playing trumpet and I was dead set on being a musician. And then I joined a band with some high school buddies and we were all friends, and Anthony wanted to be an actor, but he would introduce us.
Yeah.
He had this whole like spiel, this real slick spiel. You know, their fathers call him crazy. The girls call him all the time, but I call him like I see him and I call him Anthem. And we'd come out and start rocking our jams.
What kind of music was that?
Kind of like Prague, La Via Strangiata kind of rock,
nice.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. You know, we had our moments.
Yeah.
But, and then Anthony went to go see Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five in 1982.
Yeah.
And just, or no, 82, end of 82, and freaked out. Like, we knew hip-hop a little bit, but
right.
We didn't really know.
Right.
They had their first hit, The Message Out.
Yeah.
Saw Grandmaster Flash, and he was like, I want to rap. Because he didn't ever consider that he could sing.
Right.
But I want to rap. And I was like, well, you know, I live for the funk. I mean,
yeah.
I play funk all day long.
Right.
And so I just, like, cooked up some funk grooves, and he started rapping on them, and literally, we never had a rehearsal. Our first gig, we just kind of talked about it in my living room with Jack Irons and Hello Slovak, and I was like, you go bound, you doom, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just went out and did it. And next time we played, like, you know, 2 weeks later, it was Lines Around the Block, and it just never stopped.
I remember seeing them at the Music Machine in I guess it would be like sort of Santa Monica, West LA,
yeah,
over on Pico. And it was a great show, small club. And I remember Anthony, he had a flu or something, but he was still kicking ass, and he was throwing loogies everywhere, spitting them out. Yeah. They were green and ugly, but anyway, they sounded great. And and that's because back then was Suicidal Tendencies, Rocky George, who got me in the band. That's who I went to high school with. He was talking about this amazing bass player called Flea.
Yeah.
And I always like bass players with one name.
Yeah.
Like Jocko.
Yeah, Flea, soccer players.
You know? Yeah, exactly. You know, it's sort of this unique breed of characters.
But for you guys, for bass players, you guys are like up front, you know, full on performers. Like, you know, like historically, the bass player is just a dude hanging out in the back.
Right.
But at some point, you guys, you know, well, you took front seat.
Yeah, I think Robert and I are kind of from that generation of bass players that first kind of started. I mean, not for the fusion guys or the jazz guys,
yeah,
where they were already like, you know, virtuosos.
Yeah.
But in terms of in like the rock world, the youth culture, rock music for sure.
Watt too?
Oh, Watt for sure.
Yeah, I had him in here. Yeah. He's got his own language.
He's
that
got
guy.
Everything. He's got it all. He's a spiritual master. Oh,
yeah. He is, right?
Oh, yeah.
So he was a little before you?
I remember Perkins telling me he was showing up on tour when he toured with, when he was playing in Point of Papyrus.
Uh-huh.
He showed up on tour with his bass, no suitcase, toothbrush in his flannel pocket, and that was it. A shirt, a pair of pants, a bass, a toothbrush. I'm ready to go.
And that's
for like
it.
A 6-month tour.
Right,
you know?
Right. Straight from San Pedro, man. Yeah.
Were you guys contemporaries, or was he a little before?
Contemporaries, but yeah. Another quick Watt. So I was on a tour with Watt once, and he had diarrhea really bad.
Was that with the sickness he had, with that thing?
He had some diarrhea. I don't know. Yeah, he had diarrhea.
Yeah.
He got sick.
Yeah.
And he went out on stage and just tied his pants shut at the bottom.
I think he told me about that.
Tied them shut. Just went out there and rocked.
Oh, man.
Filled those babies up like some MC Hammer pants.
That's nice.
Well, when was the trick for you, Flea, where you know, you sort of defined your style? Was it that moment when Kiedis wanted to rap and you just got on board with that funk thing? Or?
Yeah, kind of. And before that, like I joined this band called Fear.
Yeah.
And they were a real...
With what's his
with Lee Vang and Spitsticks and Philo Kramer.
Were you in the original crew?
No. No, they kicked their bass player out for a drug problem. And so I joined and it was so intense and hard. And I really started getting into punk rock, which was a new thing for me.
Like who? Which guys?
You know, all the LA bands. I like Germs, Fear, X, The Weirdos, The Screamers, Bags.
Yeah.
You know, I like the LA bands.
Yeah.
And then it expanded.
Right.
But I liked that. It was like, you know, they were the contemporaries.
Yeah.
The guys on the scene that I looked up to. And I just started really feeling that intensity. The intensity, the immediacy. There was something about it that struck a chord in me in a really intense way. And because I grew up loving funk, and that was just really my thing, was funk, I started applying that to funk. And I started like playing funk really aggressively.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, when I would see bass players play, there's this guy in my high school, like I would see the black guys play bass and they all slapped.
Yeah.
And so I was like, whoa, that's where it's at. And so I started learning to slap.
Yeah.
And so I was doing that. And then punk rock came. And then it was just, you know, it was just like, I just started being really like violent and aggressive about it.
With the slapping.
Yeah. And found it, you know, and found my own style. And that was, you know, like 81, 82.
So that was before you recorded anything, really?
Yeah.
And now with the Suicidal Tendencies, that was straight up like hard, like punk rock and roll.
Well, when I first back in I guess it would have been 83, 84, I went to a jazz school called Dick Grove School of Music in Studio City, and I was there for a year hanging with all these jazz cats that were, some of them were a little older than me. It was funny because we would go to MI as a tribe, and our best guitar players would duel against their best guitar players. But they had all these kind of hip, you know, younger teachers, and our guys were a little older. Our guys were kind of like my main teacher at the time was a guy called Max Bennett, who was actually the bass player with Joni Mitchell. He played on some of those albums that Jocko played on.
Oh, really?
And he was an awesome bass player, but he was kind of wild and crazy. He played in a band called the LA Express, and he had a bass strap that was leather, and it had all these couples in sexual positions, like 69 position and all that kind of stuff.
With the horoscope or just
all that stuff, man.
Right.
The full sexual guitar strap. So he's kind of wild like that. And then he lasted about half the year, and the guy that took over from him was a guy called Joel DeBartolo, who was the bass player for Johnny Carson show, Doc Severinsen band.
Yeah.
And he was a wonderful teacher. So I went to jazz school, and then the minute I got out, it's like I never played jazz again. And a couple years after that, I ended up joining Suicidal Tendencies. So I was playing really high, like my bass was all up by my chin, like level 42.
Cool.
It was not cool. I didn't know that at the time. And then when I played my first show in Germany with Suicidal Tendencies opening for Anthrax. It was like this mosh pit that I'd never I mean, I loved Suicidal. I used to wear the cap and dig the music, but to be on stage and play that music in Europe, especially Germany,
yeah,
was so intense that, I mean, I was laughing because I was so happy. And gradually, obviously, the bass came down lower, lower, and lower, and lower. But that was sort of my initiation. And then, of course, I discovered bands like Slayer and of course, Metallica. But the slapping thing for me, I was always doing that. And just like Flea said, I applied it to my style, which was, you know, again, aggressive, like thinking like more percussive, you know,
right,
just being progressive and bringing, I always thought of it as a punching bag.
Right.
Like the heavy bag.
So it was a different timing too, right? Because like, you know, Flea's like popping funk and you're just, you know, integrating it into like pounding rock.
Yeah. Into the, you know, to whatever thrash or whatever you want to call it. But again, you know, I think Flea and I are pretty experimental in what we like to do, and we like so many different styles of music. There's really no rules, you know. But again, with that style of bass, you know, I always wanted to treat it like, you know, like you're in the Amazon jungle and you just
Well, what's the relationship with, like, because the rhythm sections, like, you got to hold the whole shit together. I mean, it's really on you. Right, and the drummer.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I'm sure Robert agrees with me that playing with a great drummer that really has pocket and groove, and you can just like live inside that beat and get inside his kick drum and stuff, is just a really uplifting feeling.
Because it's just you two in a way, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's everybody, yeah. But when you can really get like intimate with a drummer playing like that, it's such a great, awesome feeling. And I've been so fortunate to play with a number of incredible drummers in my life, and it's just always,
well, that's you know, what's wild about you. And yeah, you've been in a lot of bands, and you know, you've been brought into a lot of bands, and you've had to hold one band together for like decades now.
Yeah we're in our 34th year, I think.
It's wow. Crazy, man.
It's cool with a thunk,
right?
Yeah.
Do you know how many drummers and guitar players you've gone through?
Guitar players, I think 7.
Really?
Yeah, and drummers, not that we've had the same drummer since 88 or 89.
So just like three drummers.
But we had
drummers.
Like three before that.
Right,
I think four drummers, I think.
And the guy now, he's like the solid guy. He's been there forever.
Yeah, he's solid.
And you've had John Frusciante twice?
Twice, yeah. And now we have Josh Klinghoffer. Yeah.
And it's weird, because who was that one dude who played on Up With Mofo Party?
Hillel Slovak.
Right, so he passed away.
He passed away, yeah.
Because that was the first Chili Peppers album I heard, and I was like, you know, this guy is like, he's like doing something like Hendrix-y.
He definitely, yeah. Well, he was, we all loved Hendrix growing up. That was for us, like in my group of guys, that was our god, you know.
But you too?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
But when we really got into the Gang of Four when they came out, and like Echo and the Bunnymen and that English post-punk sound,
yeah.
And so, right about Hillel really like started getting really into Andy Gill and Will Sargent from Echo and the Bunnymen, and so getting into that kind of like that kind of aesthetic, like angular weird effects and colors, like synth kind of sounds.
And
he had a unique sound. It's cool.
And when he started playing with like making the shift from Suicidal Tendencies to like, you know, playing with somebody like Ozzy, you know, how do you integrate, you know, the songs already.
Right.
But how do you find, are there moments within songs like when you're playing with Ozzy where he's like, he gives you some freedom and, you know, you can kind of find your own space with
him? Yeah, there was actually Ozzy would like to take a long break in the middle of the show, and it was during a song called Suicide Solution. So. Yeah. At the time, I had the good fortune of playing with not only Zakk Wylde for a few years, but also a wonderful guitar player by the name of Joe Holmes. And with Joe, we had created this solo section in the middle of Suicide Solution, where the bass actually went into kind of a low-range percussive groove, and he would just rip, you know, Hendrix-style solo over it. And then that carried on to touring with Zakk as well. But it was a dream for me because, you know, growing up playing in backyard party bands, and we're playing, you know, like songs like, of course, Crazy Train and even obscure songs like SATO and Believer was always one of my favorite songs, Over the Mountain. And then to to join Ozzy's band and be on stage playing Sweet Leaf or Iron Man.
Right.
That's where the crab walk kind of came to be, because right. I was testing him. He got in front of me, he got in my face, yeah. and I started doing this sumo wrestler kind of move, and he did it with me.
Yeah.
So we were feeding off each other. That would have been the second show, and I remember it was Las Vegas, and it was super tight and great. So it was just a surreal moment for me to be playing with my hero. That's one of the things I think that Flea can also sort of vouch for. As we've grown as musicians, you know, you're meeting your heroes. Like, recently there was a show at the Hollywood Bowl celebrating Jaco Pastorius, and I got to meet Herbie Hancock for the first time. And I had met Wayne Shorter when we interviewed him, but,
yeah.
you know, just seeing those guys interact and... In meeting Peter Erskine, well, actually being able to play with Peter a little bit, it just, you know, Booker T and all these guys.
He's a great guy.
You know, it was really a moment for me. And then meeting even people like Jimmy Page. And
you never met him before?
I had met him in recent years
yeah.
with Metallica. And then Lemmy's become a really good friend of mine. In fact, last night I presented a Lifetime Achievement Award to him for Bass Player Magazine. And
How's he doing?
He's doing okay. He's going on tour tomorrow, today,
boy.
Actually. And that worries me, because I yeah. think he should be resting. But Lemmy doesn't want to rest, man. He wants to play rock and roll.
I had him in here. He was pretty wiped out.
Yeah.
He's got the cane.
He's a soldier.
Yeah,
he
sure is a soldier.
I tell you, interesting thing that happened a few months, well, it would have been about a year ago. I had played a special show celebrating Keith Moon and John Entwistle at the House of Blues, and I invited Joni Mitchell. I didn't think she was going to show up, but Lemmy was there because he was receiving yet another award, and he and I are talking. He's to the left of me, and he's smoking like a chimney.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I see Joni walk in. I'm like, oh my, you know, yeah. oh my God,
Joni and Lemmy.
Yeah, exactly. She sits to the right of me, and I got Lemmy to the left of me. Yeah. They're both chain smoking. And I'm like, this is the most beautiful smoke I've ever inhaled in my life. Lemmy smoke and Joni Mitchell smoke. And she looks over. Lemmy doesn't really say anything. And she looks over and he looks over. And I say, oh, okay. Well, Lemmy, this is my good friend Joni Mitchell. Joni, this is Lemmy. And she looks over at him, big old drag of the cigarette, and goes, Hello, Lemmy, like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, you know who Lemmy was.
Yeah, and then Lemmy looks over at her. He takes a big drag of the cigarette. He's like, Joni, what fucking chords were you playing on Court and Spark? I could never figure that out, you know? Or with his voice, Joni, what chords were you playing? And she starts to tell him. She goes, well, Lemmy, I do open chord tuning, you know, and that's how I write my songs. And they had this conversation. I was just sitting in the middle of this, like, happier than a pig and shit. It's like two originals that are still true to their music,
yeah.
diehards.
Right.
Always.
So it's beautiful.
Well, that's a good way to start in talking about the movie Jaco, the documentary, which I saw, I think, pretty close to this cut, right? That screening?
Pretty close to it. There's been, obviously, all the technical stuff has been completely, you know, dialed in, and meaning sound design, and there's some other edits that we had done. When you saw it, there was no intro credits or closing
right.
credits. And it's been a long haul. I mean, we're going 6 years into this. And in fact, Flea's a trooper, because we had to interview him twice. We interviewed him the first year, and the sound wasn't good because the team that I had at the time didn't have their shit together. So we had bad sound, and he was wearing a Lakers t-shirt, which is beautiful to celebrate the Lakers, but it's not good when you're trying to finance something like this. Yeah. And so we had to come back a year later, and he was like, no problem. I mean, 3 hours on the first one, and then another 3 hours, and he was there for me. So
well that's out of friendship for you, and I imagine respect for Jaco, because
absolutely.
Well, Jaco is one of these guys. What I want to ask you in terms of, like, your heroes, like Bootsy Collins, I imagine for you had a big impact, did he?
For sure.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And for you, like, when you talk about somebody like Lemmy, what is Lemmy's, like, what makes Lemmy special as a bass player?
Well, Lemmy's special because, well, I love his usage of chords.
Yeah.
And I love his sound, and you know, the fact that he's really an outlaw, you know, of rock and roll, and he's got that swagger.
Yeah.
He's like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, definitely.
And in a lot of ways, Jaco was the same way.
You know,
Jaco was a daredevil too, and he he was true to what he was doing. Though they come from, I know, I like to say, refer to it as styles, but,
right,
but the edge in the attitude is the same. And I love that.
Well, yeah. I'd always heard about, like, I'd heard about Jaco, like when I was younger and I was not a jazz head. And it's interesting for a guy that, you know, on the edge and that brilliant and that possessed by musical brilliance, like that music, I didn't listen to Weather Report when I was a kid. There was no way I was going to hear it, and I never knew who he was, but I'd always heard he was this crazy fucker that was a genius, and it didn't end well. So when I saw the documentary, which is powerful and moving, and you got the support of his family, so you were able to get the real story and the whole story and the arc of what he was involved in, what made him so amazing, it's fucking heartbreaking, the cost of talent and sort of mental illness that comes with genius sometimes.
Well, that's what that's what I wanted to share with the world. Number one, who my biggest influence was as a bass player, and also just the amazing story, and to celebrate that music in that time. And I had so many young people come up to me today and say, hey, you know, I just want you to know I'm now a fan of Jaco Pastorius and Weather Report and Joni Mitchell. And, you know, there's a movement with vinyl right now.
Yeah, I'm in it.
With Record Store Day.
A lot of money.
I never left it.
Yeah, I mean, I never left it either. But the fact that now people are reconnecting with music from that time period and even before is really special. And Jaco was really diverse. I mean, he loved all styles of music, you know,
yeah.
And he was super, super funky. So people are connecting with that now, and that's what this film's all about. It's not just a life story, but it's also, you know, a story about the time and music. And also, like you said, you know, mental, you know, when I see homeless people now, I'm not sitting there judging them, you know,
because
I know there's more to it than
yeah.
that.
Well, yeah, the fact that he ended up homeless after playing with Joni. And after, like, well into his career, he lost it a little bit.
Right.
And it's like, it's totally devastating. But, like, he's also remains this kind of romantic figure, you know, in his struggles with mental illness and also just his persistence.
Absolutely. Again, I use the word daredevil. You know, Wayne Shorter in the film calls him a superhero. And I think that's fitting.
When did you first hear Jaco?
You know, those Weather Report records.
Yeah?
Mr. Gunn and Heavy Weather and stuff.
And you were able to identify, like, through the rest of the sound, like, that guy's, like...
Yeah, well, I mean, it was a shockingly bizarre, bold, new sound that I'd never heard before.
Yeah.
I mean, just the sound of the fretless bass with the chorus pedal on it. It was just insane, man.
Yeah.
I'd never heard anything like it. And... You know, as much as it was like mind-blowingly this like psychedelic virtuoso beauty that was just, you know, and it was such a warm sound that really envelops you. But, you know, like you said, you know, I part of the movie, of course, to support Robert's endeavor,
yeah.
but just to, you know, anything to shine light on a guy that gave us so much. And because he was not a pop star,
right.
is relatively obscure to the general public.
Right.
Because people, you know, they like pop music.
And we both saw him play around the same time. Flea and I both, we weren't there together, but I know you saw him at the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
I saw him at the Hollywood Bowl with Weather Report, but I also saw him in 1979 at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. And what I saw in 1979 just changed my life on so many levels. I saw a very diverse crowd. I saw punkers, metalheads, jazzers. I saw skateboarders and surfers because Santa Monica Civic is one block from the beach. And then I also saw a guy that reminded me of the tribe that I used to see at Venice Beach skating and surfing.
Yeah.
And so I thought he was really cool. And what I've learned in the film, I mean, that guy really loved the beach. I mean,
yeah.
half the film, he's in shorts, he's got no shirt, and he's, you know, body surfing or playing frisbee.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
So I just thought, this guy is super, super rad. He's so cool. And then, you know, just taking command of the stage, I saw him, he put his bass down on one side of the stage, he took a running start, and he slid into his bass like it was sliding into home plate. And and that was just really cool, you know? So that night changed my life, and then I saw him three times after that.
Did you meet him?
Doing backflips and shit.
Oh, yeah, all that stuff.
He did backflips?
Yeah, oh, yeah, he would do a backflip on stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he was incredible.
That's what he'd do.
But also, it's like the story, like, for me,
yeah,
it's like, it's Jaco's story, and you know it a lot better than me, Robert. I know it fairly well, you know, but it's really like this archetypal story of, like, you're talking about, like, this brilliance, like, how much is to be that brilliant, how much mental illness has to accompany you to have right. that sort of discipline to focus on one thing to the exclusion of everything else. But as well, it's like, I feel like it's like this archetypal man thing to, like, go out and slay dragons. You yeah, know what I mean? Yeah. It's like you leave your family and you go out in the world and you're going to fuck shit up and you're going to win your, beat your demons, your personal demons or exterior demons, depending how you grew up, what they are. But we all have them.
Right.
To some extent, in some way. And you arm yourself with whatever weapons you can, which in Jocko's case was this base, you yeah. know, that he creates this beautiful weapon, this yeah. beautiful fucking thing that's capable of, like, you know, just really touching people's hearts and blowing people's minds. But ultimately, he can't slay that dragon and he loses.
Yeah.
Because the mental illness and the drugs overcome him and he ends up, you know, becoming too self-destructive and dying. And it's so like the story of mankind, yeah, you know, even yeah. though sometimes people win. But yep. it's you know, it's like you ever read Beowulf?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like that kind of shit. It's like this age old, since the beginning of time, we all have to have these serious battles that we have to fight and we have to do it.
Yeah.
It's either that or just be nothing. Like,
right, disappear.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Disappear and become, you know, an empty person.
And also there's that feeling, like, I imagine you feel it, and both of you guys, like, when you are an artist, you know, you have your life, you have your demons, you have the troubles that exist in the real world, but when you get up on stage, it's different. The whole world is different.
Right, but maybe, like, the bigger the battle, the more intense you have to be, and that's why someone like Jocko is so great.
And didn't he invent the fretless electric bass, kind of?
Well, actually, you know, James Jamerson might have been the one who, at least for electric bass,
yeah.
you know, that's debatable. It's like people were, you know, with Tony Alva back in the day as a skater, you know, did he do the first air, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of people, you know, in like San Bernardino that probably said, I did the first air, fuck that shit, yeah, man, yeah. you know. But Jocko made the fretless bass sing like it hadn't happened before. I mean, he gave it a voice, a melodic voice, that was just so powerful and dynamic. And he was such a great collaborator with that instrument. Whether he was collaborating with Joni Mitchell or collaborating with Ian Hunter, you know, on the song All American Alien Boy, he was very young at that time. And the solo on that song might be one of the greatest rock bass solos, you know, ever, and not a lot of people have heard it. So, you know, he was, again, a great collaborator with a very unique sound and powerful sound that could be so beautiful but also so angry and just abrasive in a beautiful kind of way, you know,
and so, like, instantly identifiable. I don't think yeah. I can't think of another musician ever really in the history of music with a more instantly identifiable sound. A bass player, like, just an instrument in the band, like, the second you hear it, it's him.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no question. It's like, oh, could that be some studio guy? Maybe he was aping him? Yeah. No, because no one could ever do it. And a million guys tried.
They
and
did.
No one could come, not yeah. even close. Like, it's so mildly transcendent above everything else, no one could come close. I was listening this morning, I listened to Don Juan's Reckless Daughter.
Right.
It's like, give me a fucking break of the power and the beauty of it. Like you feel, like, in the beauty, you feel the vulnerability and the anger, too, like you said, right. you know,
yeah.
and the violence. But it's just like liquid love, man. Fuck.
It's like magic. Like, I mean, because, like, it's weird because somebody can be an amazing virtuoso but not have that fucking depth or feel.
Yeah.
So do you remember, like for you, Flea, Robert was talking about, you know, jazz and everything else, but when you were coming up, who was the bass player that you identified as, like, the guy that was like, I'm going that way?
When I started playing bass?
Yeah.
Man, I don't know. I was so into trumpet players, you know, but the first, I just liked bass lines and stuff. I mean, Jocko was the first guy where it's like, this is the greatest electric bass player on earth. There's no question. This is the greatest guy.
Yeah.
But there are just guys, I like the way certain guys sound in certain bands that aren't really the greatest guys.
Yeah.
You know what yeah. I mean? Like, I love Billy Cox. And
yeah,
then,
yeah.
Like, I really love Billy Cox is playing in the band of Gypsies.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
And it's just really simple hypnotic bass, but yeah, it touches me, you know?
Right, right.
And, you know, Paul McCartney's bass playing is stellar and, like, unbelievable.
Phil Lesh, where does Phil Lesh stand in the pantheon?
Phil Lesh is great. I mean, you know, he's kind of created his own thing, you know, and obviously there's a lot of jam bands out there that,
yeah.
you know, are pulling something from him.
Ant Whistle?
Entwistle, yeah, he's awesome. Geezer Butler from Sabbath.
Yeah, yeah,
just
yeah.
So bad.
And he wrote most of those fucking songs, right? Well,
yeah, the lyrics.
Geezer's the guy. Yeah. Who wrote most of yours? Do you write with Anthony?
We all write together communally, and usually the songs always start with either, I mean, not always, but 90% of the time start with either something I came up with or the guitar player came up with.
And in the movie, you've got Geddy Lee, you got Sting, you got, who are some of the other bass players?
Well, you've got Jerry Bootsy. Jamont. Jerry Jamont was Jocko's favorite electric bass player.
He was incredible, man.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Show, at your show.
Yeah.
Dude.
And he's another guy that's had demons following around for many, many years. But he played on B.B. King, The Thrill Is Gone. He played with Aretha Franklin. He even played on Mr. Bojangles, that song back in the day. And he came up with Muscle Shoals and Dwayne Allman back in the day. They were like the band.
Right, you right.
Know, and early on. And then he kind of stepped away from that and just was a total session guy around New York and everything. And so Anthony Jackson, you know, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. I mean, he cut that track when he was like 17, man, you know, and he's not in the film, but we did interview him, and he's in our bonus section. You know, there's just so many tremendous players that were involved in
this.
What
about Sting? You guys like Sting?
You know, it's funny for me. I like him fine. He's great. But yeah. I mean, it's a weird thing for me is that when I was young, I loved the Police.
Yeah.
Like around the time when I started playing rock bass too, I really loved the Police, but it's the one band and it's really the only band. Like any band I listen to, I go put on the record and I'm like, yeah. I love it as much as when I was 15 or 20 or whatever. But like I put on the Police, I got the greatest hit, so I became a put on. I was just like,
It didn't hold up for you.
It's the only band ever. And I still know it's good. Yeah. Like the craftsmanship is good, the scene is good, but it just, I don't know, it's weird.
I saw
people think
Police.
I'm a moron.
I saw the Police at the, I think it was not Santa Anita, it was the Hollywood, the racetrack, the horse races.
Recently or back in the day?
No, back in the day, man. I was in high school. It was great. I mean, Thompson Twins opened up, and I remember they had like a tea break in the middle of their show, like an intermission, but it was them having tea.
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty cool. Sting's always been super cool to me, and obviously he's a musician who tries different things. He's into experimenting. Yeah. He's into expanding. And
he's one of those guys, though. He's sort of like Bono, where the personality sort of starts to hinder the appreciation of the music after a certain... You don't have to say anything on that, but I just like... It's just sort of interesting. Like with Sting, because I like the Police, but at some point I'm like, Sting just becomes Sting and I can't separate him from...
For me, he's one of those guys who's a really good musician without doubt. He's a great musician and he's willing to try lots of different stuff. It just... I don't cry or go to...
You don't get moved.
I don't get moved.
Yeah.
But I respect it. I just don't get moved.
Now, I got in trouble from some people in Canada for sort of dismissing Rush the other day. I don't remember who I was. I was talking to Albini. And, you know, Albini, you know, he'll drag you down to some places where you end up saying things that you might not...
But
really
I'll tell you something. Rush is like the easiest band in the world to make fun of.
Yeah.
That, you know, Geddy Lee's voice and it's funny and
the million drums.
And all the million drums, but... They're so unique, and they're so rad, and they're such good players, and there's nothing else like them.
Right.
And they're Rush, and like, I loved Rush. Like, when I first started playing bass, like, I wanted the virtuoso stuff, so I liked, that's why I had Hemispheres, that album. And I was like, I'd listen to that, and Hendrix, and then I got into punk rock, and it all changed, but I don't know. I love Rush.
Well, that's interesting because like, you guys
I love
had,
Rush, too.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay, it's on the record. So, but you guys had so much in place... technique wise and then like because I hear you talking about jazz with a certain love and you obviously have love for it too and then you sort of get into punk rock or you get into thrash or whatever you never felt like you were abandoning some other thing that had more integrity?
No, because integrity is what you make of it. I mean, when you the notes that you hit, how you play, how you perform, how you create, you know, that to me is integrity. You know, it's like I feel like I've earned my stripes.
Sure.
All these years, I just turned 51 and
youngster.
I feel blessed, you know. I mean, I played with all my heroes.
It's amazing.
And,
still.
So I don't know. I don't know really how to answer that.
Well, wait, let me ask it a different way. Would you like to make a jazz record?
I could make a jazz record right now. You got some recording gear. I could do it. I'll try. I mean, I don't know how good it's going to be, but
would you make a jazz record?
Yeah, hell yeah. I've made jazz records, or played on them.
Yeah.
But the thing for me, like in terms of that question, it was never about abandoning anything. Like when I got into punk rock, it didn't mean, oh, I can't like Zeppelin now because it's not cool. Or I can't listen to Louis Armstrong every day when I go home like I still do. But the thing for me, it was just a huge lesson in it that changed my life. Was that it wasn't about, up to that point, it was like I was really into virtuosity and musicianship.
Right.
And punk rock taught me that the emotional intent and the purity in the intent is where the integrity is. It's not in the
style.
It's not in the style or how, you know, athletic you are on your instrument. Like, I appreciate virtuosity, and that never left. I still appreciate virtuosity, but I don't appreciate virtuosity for the sake of showing, you know, to prove how fast you are.
Empty like, noodling.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I just like for me, like I would like the Germs are a really big band for me. I listened to that record GI over and over and over. And it really affected me in a profound way and I was like, you know, it's remedial music.
Yeah.
But it, you know, no one else could do it.
Right.
And it's just one of those things. It's like, you know, like a great painter like Basquiat or something where it's like, you know, a billion guys have copied him. No one can make a painting that looks like that.
Yeah.
And it's just like childish scribbling.
Right.
I mean, you know what I mean?
No, absolutely.
So like that with music too. Like I never stopped liking shit that I like. Police is the only band. And I still don't not like them.
Right.
I just don't want to put it on. Like I used to put it on, like I'd pull over and be like, fuck, you know, Regatta de Blanc, that record, you know.
Yeah.
All that shit. Like it really affected me. I went to go see him play at the Forum. It blew my mind. Stuart Copeland's drums, I was sitting behind him.
Yeah.
And on the toms it said, fuck off, you cunt. Which he did for Sting because he fucking hated Sting.
Right.
You know? And
really?
Yeah. And before this, the thing I really like was before the show, they played the whole Bob Marley Exodus album in the Forum really loud.
Oh, that's awesome.
That was rad.
Well, you know, I think that's the amazing thing about rock music in general is that it's not about whether the music is simple. It's what you bring to it feeling wise and, you know, how you communicate with it, right?
Exactly. You know,
did you get to meet Jocko?
I had an encounter with him, actually. There was a guitar show in Hollywood called the Los Angeles Guitar Show. It was at the Merlin Hotel. I believe that's now like a Holiday Inn Express or something. In each room was a different guitar company, you know, or a cable company or an amp company. And I was in this one room and I heard this really loud. It was actually kind of annoying. Like the bass was just turned way up and the walls were shaking. It was kind of scary. And the windows were rattling. And I went in that room kind of pissed off. And I look in there and it's Jocko. And there's no one else. There's one guy in the room, a rep. And he's sitting down and he's playing this bass. And I was like, whoa. He was like walking into a brick wall. Just like, whoa, you know.
Yeah.
This is heavy.
Yeah.
I didn't say anything to him, but I took a knee about 10 feet from him. And he's just like staring at me. But I had this big smile and I was just so amazed. And the room filled up. I mean, within like a minute, it was packed, you know. And everybody was just in there. And then he started playing grooves and quotes from his own stuff. Also quotes from Jerry Jamont and, you know, James Jamerson. And he's looking at everybody right in the eyes. He's not smiling. He's looking at us and sizing us up, like almost like I can kick all of your asses right now. And so don't even mess with me. Because at that time, he wasn't he was having a hard time.
Right.
1985. But we were just so stoked to have him even size us up. It was this is great. And then his girlfriend at the time, she was beautiful. She was like a kind of tall surfer gal, and she, I never forget, she had like a pair of jean shorts on, and she had like an OP hoodie on, and she had two cans of beer in her pocket, one in each pocket, and she said, Jocko, come on, let's go, you know, just like that, straight out. And he got up, he put the bass down, and he left us all there hanging, and we were super stoked.
She's like, quit fooling around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Come on, let's go.
Quit fooling around playing bass. Let's go.
Let's go drink some beers.
Let's go have a beer.
Let's go get high.
But it was like, it was crazy because I was so shy back then. And now I'm like, man, I would have bought him a burger or something. You know, we would have gone out, gone to the beach and gone surfing or something.
Well, you probably wouldn't have allowed it.
Yeah, right?
Maybe not.
Well, you made this amazing movie. And how long did it take to make it?
Nearly 6 years. And
was the holdup?
Well, each year we get new treasures. Like Joni came on board year 4. Yeah. Jerry Jamont came on board year 3.5. You know, Paul Marchand, my director, he's a trooper. I mean, he's been there for the 6 years, and honestly, at one point, I think he was losing his mind and he needed a break, and Scorsese called him. And he went and made a film with Scorsese, edited for him for 6 months in New York, and that needed to happen. That was the only time he left for an extended amount of time. And he actually had been offered a lot of gigs with a lot of big directors, and he's just recently was doing he's still kind of think doing something with Morgan Neville, who did that film 20 Feet from Stardom.
Oh,
so
yeah.
He was a real soldier and a trooper, and. We had Stephen Kayak for a while, who had done that film, Scott Walker, 30th Century Man. And you know, every person that's been involved in this project as a producer or a whatever line producer or just helping us get there, you know, where we needed to go. I got to commend them, because without these different people, these soldiers, I call them, we wouldn't be where we are now. And it's been a long haul, and I've gone to film school for 6 years. You know, I learned so much, and I could not do this again like that.
Because yeah.
I found myself in Central Florida at like 4 a.m, you know, like with one of Jocko's friends, you know, driving back from kind of Melbourne, Florida down to Fort Lauderdale. And he's falling asleep at the wheel, literally. And I'm hitting him going, wake up. And I'm thinking,
I don't want to die in Florida.
I'm like, geez, I got my two kids and my wife back home. It's like, what am I doing? You know, questioning everything, but, you know, battled through it. But again, I have to thank every one of those people. Is, you know, again, this guy Bob Bobbing, who, you know, really helped us with the early years, and he was really carrying the torch for Jocko early on when nobody cared, and got a lot of magazine covers for Jocko and helped get him back on the map. And I think things happen for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, you just I inherited this. You know, I had when I first met Jocko's son in 1996. You know, I in Fort Lauderdale, I said, someday you got to make a film about your father. You know, it needs to be done. His influence is so broad and wide to so many different types of musicians, and like Flea or Getty, or, you know, who a lot of gospel players, funk players, R&B, punkers, rock, whatever. And he said, yeah, we're going to do it, you know. And over time, I get the occasional call. And finally, I got involved in the project. And then I really just decided I would finance it, and that's it. That's where we are. Because to make a film like this of quality, you know, you got to just really dive in all the way.
And was the family always with you, or was that a struggle?
It you know, on and off. I mean, yeah. There were times where I'm sure they hated us, and there were times where they kind of loved us. And now we're all cool. We've always been cool, but I don't blame them, because along the way, you have a journey like this, and you're going to come up with edits and cuts that people aren't going to like for whatever reason. And at the time, you're kind of questioning why, but then you realize what, like now I know why, you know,
yeah.
I know why the film is great and what it took to get here. And I look back to those times where I was like, well, man, what's going on? Whatever. I'm just trying to keep people happy and make sure I had my creative vision still intact,
uh-huh.
and take care of my director. But take care of the family too, you know?
So when's it going to release? Is it going to release in theaters?
We've done a number of film festivals and independent theatrical screenings around the U.S. But we are going to release VOD on December 1.
Mm-hmm.
And on the 27th of November, we're actually going to release on DVD. So you go to your local record shop, whatever, you know, you'll find it there, even places like Guitar Center. And then on November 22nd, we're doing the LA premiere at the Ace Theater in downtown Los Angeles. And that's going to be a really amazing event, because my dream was to screen this thing at the Ace Theater. It's such a beautiful venue. And to be able to do that was a dream come true. And we're going to have some live music. Felix Pastorius, who's an amazing bass player. And I know you can vouch for that.
That's his son?
He's a badass.
He's a badass. He's playing with his band from Brooklyn called Hipster Assassins. And then I'll be playing a set of music with another incredible bass player, Armand Sabaleco, and actually Brooks Wackerman, who's the younger drummer of Chad Wackerman. And he's been with me a long time. And you know, maybe we're going to twist Flea's arm to get up and play a special song with us.
Will that take a lot of twisting?
No.
we tracked a special song called Come On, Come Over, and it all sort of blossomed off of a jam that we had at
you and Flea?
At Flea's studio, yeah, with Armand, and it's so great. It's so funky.
Oh, that sounds like a blast. Yeah. Now, what are you guys recording now?
Yep.
New Chili Peppers record?
Yep.
Yeah?
Yep.
How's that going?
Great.
He's not allowed to talk.
Oh, he's not allowed to talk about it? It's top secret?
I mean, they can't stop me, but I just, we're recording yet.
Screw the label?
I'm just not going to talk about it. I just feel like it's not appropriate.
You guys all getting along?
Yeah, we love each other.
That's sweet. And you guys, is Metallica recording?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, how's that going?
It's going great.
Great.
Hopefully you'll have an album next year.
Well, thanks for talking, fellas. I'm excited about the movie, and congratulations on finishing it. And it was great when I saw it. I'm sure I'm going to go in and watch the DVD again.
All right. Well, thanks so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, good to meet you guys.
Nice to meet you, Mark.
Right on.
Fuck, man. It's exciting. It's exciting, man. It's exciting to have modern rock royalty right here in the fucking garage. And Trujillo, he brought me this little amp that is signed. That's very nice of him. Brought me this little Ampeg thing that's signed by him and Flea. But I'm not gonna play through it. I'll play though, man. I'll fucking play.
Boomer Live!